It's the Atheist Identity Edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, we discuss, is there an atheist identity? What does it mean? And should we embrace it or run for the hills? Let's begin episode 223.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Welcome to Radio Freethinker 2.0. This is Don, your skeptical philosopher, political science, and, well, just the skeptic specialist. Joining me today is Randolph Richardson from the Atheist Frontier, where no man has dared go before. Say hello, Richard. Randolph.
Hello.
So, today, I'm going to start off with a bit of a rant. People may or may not have been known, but Syria has been in the news recently, and the Americans are wanting to do things. The recent kerfuffle has been over basically a gas attack that the Syrian government apparently has done on its own people. The UN has, as it should do, send in UN inspectors to say, hey, was this really a gas attack or was it not? Because there's been a lot of controversy whether it's been a real gas attack happening there or not. Then, of course, the second big action comes in. Was it the Syrian government or was it the rebels? Because many people point out, if it's the Syrian government, really, they're the ones that have the most to lose because this is such a red line issue. And actually, I thought it's been really, really kind of weird because they've mentioned the UN inspectors going in. And now all of a sudden, everyone's saying, oh, yes, we know it's them. We know it's a gas attack. It's happened about a dozen times before. And I'm going, well, if it's happened a dozen times before, why is now such a big thing? And it's weird because you see the U.S. government rushing to action. It's like, you know, now we have to, it's the hour of decision. We have to do this right away. And you have to kind of wonder, well, why is there such a big rush on this? Do you have any ideas, Ruth?
I haven't put much thought into it yet.
No problem. Well, I mean, we all can't be really hyper nerds like I am with regards to politics and all that. That's one of my pet areas of specialty. It's sad too because, I mean, the U.S. is such a bad history now of misjudging these sort of things. I mean, everyone says, well, you know, whoops, we got it wrong, but what's going to be the harm? And most notably, of course, was the convincing slam dunk evidence they had of Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, which turned out to be totally wrong. So you can understand why people are a bit, I don't know, incredulous as to what might be happening now with Syria.
Or skeptical.
Exactly. And it's even more, again, complicated because one of the traditional allies of the U.S. when these doing these things is the U.K. And the U.K. just recently defeated a resolution in which they would support some form of military action on Syria, which on the one hand is great, democracy at work. But for the Americans, it's like, damn, now all we've got is the French. And the American history with the French has never been quite so odd. I mean, ironically enough, the British were in with the U.S. in the invasion of Iraq, and the French weren't. But the French have been really big on the whole, let's police the world now, because they were in with Libya. They were in with, they want to go in with Syria. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, one of the reasons why the UK rejected their particular call is because they want to wait for the UN inspectors. So, as I said, the UN inspectors have gone in there. They've collected evidence. They've done that sort of stuff. But, you know, they haven't gone past that. They haven't actually finished the report. They haven't actually drawn any conclusions. All of this are sort of leaks and slips and that sort of stuff. So the UN is kind of in holding pattern. But unfortunately, even if the UN isn't in a holding pattern, you have the other problem is that Russia, which is a really, really close ally to Syria, has a veto on
the military action.
Yeah, the, what is it, the
preemptive strike?
Permanent Committee Oh, okay. Wow. I can't believe I can't think of that right now. Huh. If this was recorded before show, I could edit that out. But anyhow. Security Council. They have a veto on the Security Council, which is really the only arm that's authorized with using military force anywhere in the world. So effectively, this makes the UN option impossible in any goes. And because of that, if the U.S. or Israel, which is the other one who is definitely pioneering a way to do something, were to actually do anything, it would technically be illegal. It would be the United States that would actually be legally against the law. I mean, the U.N. does have this idea, the responsibility to protect, which is a framework for intervention when, such as in Libya's case, the government is killing its own civilians. But that's just a framework. It's sort of a norm. It's not really legal justification or a law. Mm-hmm. And, of course, American intervention has its own particular history as well. I mean, let's not forget the Korean War, which is still technically going on, right? And the one time the UN kind of got its act together and did something that I think was probably valid at the time, but it didn't really turn out. And then, of course, you have Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya. And Libya is a big one, important one in this particular case, because with Libya, the ostensive reason that Russia and China went along with that, because that was sanctioned by the UN, was it was going to only protect citizens. But it turned into regime change, which was something more than what, especially China doesn't like the idea of regime change ever. And Russia, again, you know, it wants to protect its own its favorites. So it didn't want to go there.
They want to get along with their neighbors.
Exactly, yeah. Now, of course, you know, Syria itself is such a conflicting country. Complicated area. I mean, you not only have sort of the government against the people, you have Sunnis versus the Shiites, right? And the rebels are very strongly supported by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, who are pumping in lots of money and trying to volunteer fighters. And then, of course, you go, oh, well, that makes them what? And then they say, oh, yes, and did we also mention Al-Qaeda? And Al-Qaeda branches are also part of the rebel forces. And then you say, oh, well, in that case, we should support Assad because, you know, obviously Al-Qaeda, especially from an American standpoint, is like, oh, that's horrible. But then Assad, of course, is supported by Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas. So there's really no good guy in this particular fight, which, again, you know, what do you do with that? In fact, there was a, I think it's called Geneva 2 or Geneva 1, I forget which it's called, where the Russians basically strong-armed Assad and the Syrian government to come, let's sit down and have a peace talk. And the Americans, of course, were supposed to get the United Rebel Movement to provide membership, and they couldn't do it. There was no one sort of to be in that rebel movement. Then, of course, you know, the United States right now is toting the idea that, well, we're going to take the moral high ground that, you know, yes, it might technically be illegal because there is no legal framework for doing all this. And sure, we might be going alone. But, and I think I'm quoting or paraphrasing Obama when he says, our strength not only lies in our military force, but in our moral convictions. That, you know, gassing your people is just somehow so much wrong. But then again, the Americans provided military intelligence to Iraq when it used gas weapons against Iran in its particular war. And let's not forget the moral hypocrisy about the Americans cannot say dash coup that went on, which has gone so far to the point now where the Muslim Brotherhood and opposition parties are being banned as illegal, which strikes me as definitely a rollback, if not an end to the democratic experiment that was there. Although, to be fair, Egypt never was really a democracy. They won the right to vote, but they didn't really have democracy yet. But who knows? And then, of course, that also leads to another interesting question about why gas? I mean, I understand that it's a bar, and it is morally reprehensible, but tens of thousands of people have already been killed in this war, civilians among them. And that seems to be okay somehow. I mean, we hate it, but we're not willing to step in and save their lives. But you get about 100 or so people who die from gas, and suddenly it's like, flick, it's morally reprehensible, and I don't know what to do. Before we go to our first commercial, did you have any thoughts, Richard? I know you're more comfortable with, you know, having prepared material, and I'm off the cuff kind of guy. Yeah. But I'm just do you think gas is worse than bullets if someone gets killed?
Well, I think in the end you're killing people against their will, and that's what the real problem is. And bullets are very painful, where I imagine gas is probably a very different experience. I don't know.
True.
They're both bad, and it'd be nice if there was objection right from the beginning instead of waiting until X number of people have died.
Yeah, well, and it's been, like, what, two and a half years now that this particular conflict is going on?
Yeah.
What about the idea then, and again, just to help break things up and get ready for our next big segment, if you were on the street and you saw somebody killing someone across the street, your immediate action would probably be to try, I mean, assuming you weren't worried about your own safety, but to rush in and try and save that person. Does that analogy hold for a state? I mean, why is a state somehow less obligated to step in and save a life, whereas if it was a person, if it was a me to do it, it would seem to me that I would be judged morally wrong if I sat back and did nothing?
I don't think that it applies less to a state. Governments, I think, were originally put in to stop the strong from oppressing the weak and to protect people. And it's supposed to be a two-way thing. You know, people will serve in the military and be good Samaritans in their country and help it progress. And the government will protect them so they can do these things safely. So I think it is the government's duty to step in and try to protect its citizens. So.
Good, yeah. So I guess I have to say, you know, somebody should step in. I mean, actually, I think one of the best parties maybe would be like a Turkey or something like that, who is nominally, you know, westernized. So, you know, there's none of this sort of religious overtones that would be involved if, like, Saudi Arabia or Iraq intervened.
Okay.
They're in the area, so, and they don't appear to have any, what's the word, any back end where they can benefit from. I mean, a lot of people bring up with Libya, one of the reasons we intervened with Libya, they had oil. Syria doesn't have so much of that, but it's a conduit for a lot of oil and gas that comes from other parts of the area. But who knows? Let's just got that off my chest. I'm glad you all could listen. So we are going to go for a commercial, and when we come back, we're going to talk about atheist identity.
Red Jam Slam Society presents Radio Fest Fundraiser on September the 6th, 2013, 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Radio Cafe, 101 Hastings Street in Vancouver on the corner of Columbia. Come and meet our lineup of Aboriginal professionals in our ever-expanding cultural industry, featuring model Jolene Alicia Mitten and carver Andy Wesley. With these artists and more, we will be raising funds for our first ever radio festival to be held within days on September 10th to the 13th in celebration of reconciliation. For more information, please go to redjamslam.com.
And we're back. So, we're back here, and we're going to talk about atheist identity. Now, to me, the idea of not believing in something should not, in itself and in isolation, constitute an identity. But at the same time, there seems to be this idea of an atheist identity.
No, I don't think that there can be an atheist identity. See, I regard atheism as merely a classification of absence of theism, which implies an absence of belief in deities and supernatural agents. Nothing more, nothing less. Atheism, I see, is something that's exempt from carrying any burden of proof because it makes no claims about anything. It is entirely unimposing and non-oppressive. It's not something people need to follow along with and don't have anything to adhere to. Although I'm an atheist, I can't agree with there being any such thing as an atheist identity due to the lack of any doctrine, and because there are so many different factors that could be used to identify people. The problem I see with assuming that there is an identity is that it implies conformity, which requires extending the meaning of atheism beyond the mere classification that it is. Being free-thinking and open-minded are two personality traits among many atheists who I know. which I think also make it very difficult to create any sense of atheist identity. Add skepticism to this list of traits, and you've now introduced a potential divide between skeptical and non-skeptical atheists, and it goes on and on like that. Although skepticism certainly does play an important role for many who prefer that their choice to be an atheist be rationally justified, it's not actually required, since people can also freely choose to be atheists or for non-skeptical reasons, as well as for no reason at all.
So let me ask you then, If I'm reading from your perspective, the concept of atheist then is actually meaningless. It actually holds no meaning. Anything more than saying I am a chess player because I don't like playing chess, or I don't believe that chess is a game, or an a-capitalist because I'm a lefty and I think capitalism is a myth.
Oh, sure. And those are good points. I would say without conflict, though, rather than meaningless, because it's the awareness of atheism that makes atheism meaningful. And that also doesn't mean it's any less important than theism. It's our conversations, I think, about atheism and sports and political systems that make these concepts meaningful. Similarly, the power granted by people to sports heroes and politicians can make them influential, powerful, and more effective.
Okay. I don't know. I would take it... I'm trying to think here now how the best to do this is that somehow it seems to be more like trivialized or somehow that... Mm-hmm. It's secondary to atheism, or at least in my view, what secondary atheism is, atheism is skepticism, right? And because you've given no meaning to atheism, I mean, from my perspective, an atheist who doesn't believe just because isn't making any more of a statement than I don't like broccoli, which, I mean, does have value unto itself. But the rejection of a belief system, which is imposed upon us in more on that later, but without cause, is somehow seems to be somewhat intellectually dishonest, that, you know, the market will solve all problems because it's good, full stop, is like I'm making a comment about something, but I really don't have any validity in making that statement at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, when people say they are atheists, they're actually making a statement that they aren't theists. So there definitely is a statement being made, although it's rather passive. I think atheism should be trivial, though. But it isn't because there are strong market forces that have designs to eliminate it. Just as some religions try very hard to rule the world, commercial market forces seem to create more problems than they solve. And that's probably why we have so many regulations. However, I do think that atheism is a very large demographic, and it's a demographic that's growing rapidly now, from what I can see. And I think more access to education and information is part of the reason for this.
So, sorry, to play off that then,
okay.
and to go back with what you had sort of said beforehand, why is education and information necessary to promote atheism, which is, in your very limited sense, the non-belief in something, which really means almost, and I don't mean this sarcastically.
Oh, that's okay.
Less knowledge would be better, because if you never knew about the Catholic Church, then you wouldn't have to worry about being a Catholic theist, if you know what I mean.
But I'm not saying less knowledge is better.
But you mentioned that education and information are something that would help promote atheism, would help lead to its expansion. And I'm wondering how that works if, almost in the sense, less education would mean there'd be more atheists. And this is, like I say, a very narrow, perverted
sure.
version of education.
I think if people are better educated, they can make better informed decisions about things. With skepticism, I think it was Matt Dillahunty who once said, from the Atheist Experience, he said that skepticism is an ideology that leads to atheism, ultimately. And because you're questioning everything,
yeah.
and you're being impartial about it. And if people have more education, then I think skepticism comes more naturally, because they have more things to compare with and say, hey, wait a sec, this isn't right. Maybe this needs to be questioned. And we hope to encourage that with education, I would think.
And don't get me wrong, I'm at no point saying that we
yeah.
need a less educated
yeah.
and less informed population. It's a thought experiment.
It helps us get more progress in our society, technologically and otherwise, I think.
Exactly. So we don't live in Mars. We don't live in Plato's Republic. We live in Canada or the United States, if you're listening, or Iran, if we have listeners in Iran.
I hope so.
Yes. And we live in a religious culture. I mean, as much as we want to say we're a secular state, as much as we want to say that, you know, religion shouldn't play any role in public life, the vast majority of people are religious. Mm-hmm. And as such, does religious culture sort of force this identity on us? I mean, for example, there are parallels between being an atheist in a Christian nation or being gay in a straight nation. The identity is, again, not something that we necessarily want or we're insisting to have, but it's thrust on us because we are different.
Okay. Well, indeed, some people do try to impose identities on atheists, perhaps to vilify or isolate in some cases, just as some try to isolate people for other reasons, such as the ones you mentioned. And I think it's a shame that such intolerance is commonly permitted.
I'm not sure quite if I'd go along with the idea of isolated as opposed to ignored. I think, some of these issues, you know, have been going on for a long time, and as long as you sort of sat down, shut up, and didn't talk about it, societies were willing to sort of tolerate it in the background. I think one of the reasons for the recent atheist backlash is not so much that religion wants to suppress atheism, although it obviously doesn't like the idea of atheism, but the fact that atheists are beginning to stand up and demand a sense of equality, that we don't want to be put into the corner and told to shut up. In that context, by forcing us to sort of demand our rights, and by us, I mean us atheists, again, in parallel perhaps with the queer rights or even racial equality, that in an odd junction from both being different and from the norm, as well as demanding not only recognition but equality. I mean, that's the identity, is that I just want to be treated as equal because I don't have a religious identity. I have an a-religious identity.
Well, with people being more educated, they're more aware, I think, of the fact that they have options for having different lifestyles and whatnot. I think people are demanding freedom increasingly, and religion often becomes an adversary to this because it espouses values and virtues that require imposing restrictions and limitations. I don't think equality, I think you mentioned equality, I mm-hmm. don't think equality is a realistic possibility, but I think striving for the fair and equal treatment of people certainly is. I think that's the real goal that equality advocates are fighting for.
Deep breath. So, why isn't it a realistic possibility?
Well, because people have different capabilities. So, it's not possible for people, a very strong person and a very weak person, to both be capable of doing the same kind of physical job. But they can certainly strive for some kind of equal treatment where they all have equal amount of rights. So they can have their own beliefs, they can hold their own opinions, and they can inquire freely about things. So these kinds of things.
Okay. So I find it interesting, and not so much for you, but from religious people, their attempts to sort of pigeonhole or ghettoize atheists. You know, often there are sort of these ad hominem attacks that label atheists as dogmatic or atheism as a religion. You know, and I mean, like, somehow Richard Dawkins is our version of the Pope. Thoughts?
He's not my pope. He's a representative. I have of his views. I have tremendous respect for
some of his views.
Yeah, I guess I'm not aware of all his views, yes, but yes. The mainstream ones I've heard, I certainly like. Occasionally, I also encounter the assumption that atheism is dogmatic or is a belief system that actively opposes belief in deities. And I don't agree with this application of the guilt by association logical fallacy on atheists, as if we're all anti-theists, especially since there are many atheists who aren't opposed to theism. In case that seems a bit confusing, and some people do find it that way, because of certain terms suffer from varying definitions, I consider that the word theism, which, when combined with the prefix anti to make the word anti-theism, gains an emphatically oppositional property. On the other hand, the a prefix, when combined with theism to make the word atheism, merely indicates the impartial absence of theism. After dividing people into different groups or fitting them into various identities, I find it interesting that other efforts to find similarities eventually begin to materialize. It's as if there's a make-work project at play somehow, although I suspect it's more likely a desire for human kinship and the prevention of loneliness. Although labels and identities are helpful, as they are an important part of language and the free exchange of information, the use of labels for nefarious purposes can also have an equally unhelpful effect. And I mention that because people often start talking about labels when these conversations come up. Instead of fostering division, I prefer to embrace diversity as an important strength that depends on personal differences, particularly on a rather large scale, which conformity tends to limit or prevent. Conformity, when escalated to reject diversity, can foster social problems by ostracizing and dividing people. If more efforts were focused on inclusion rather than exclusion, then I think society could be a much healthier as a whole. And that's one of the beauties of atheism. It doesn't impose expectations. There are no minimum or maximum requirements in any category, aside from not being a theist. And since being a theist is also optional, at least in countries like Canada and the USA, where we value freedom constitutionally, people can choose to be atheists, theists, or anti-theists as often as they like, and for as long as they like. The most important point is that people don't necessarily have to accept an identity that's been thrust upon them, and I don't think it's necessarily healthy to try to live up to someone else's arbitrary expectations, no matter how strongly they're imposed.
I'm interested in the idea that you know, we should be able to reject an identity that would be thrust upon us, right? Which,
yeah.
I mean, is quite valid. But at the same time, one could make the same argument about, you know, the lazy Hispanic or whatever is an identity thrust upon Hispanics by a racist culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that they should reject that, which is great. They should. I mean, obviously, that's not true or anything. But at the same time, the fact that that has been put upon them has itself ramifications. So your views about, you know, let's be a diverse society and all
mm-hmm.
that,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if that really addresses the fact that as an atheist, we do face at times discrimination, even here in Canada, that, you know, in certain countries, we have to worry about being killed because we might say the wrong thing to the wrong person.
Yeah, in some countries, that's a very serious consideration, as we've seen recently. Was it Myanmar where that happened, or one of these countries?
Yeah, Bangladesh is the
Bangladesh,
one I always
maybe it's Bangladesh. Yeah, yeah, or there are people actually asking for their death.
And I guess what I'm getting at here is, I mean, I agree with what you're saying, so mm-hmm. I'm not being critical with that. But it sounds more utopian optimism.
Yeah.
Again, you know, people know that I am what I would call an evangelical fundamentalist sort of atheist.
I like that. I like that a lot.
But the charge, well, so before going on, so I'm and one of the reasons why I feel a need to be like that is that, you know, there is a certain amount of inequality that we must face and we must resist against, that in a way, and I hate to use this terminology, but maybe you can come up with a better one, by labeling them, as in the theists, as someone who has power over us,
mm-hmm.
that in that sense, the it's a way. It's a method of self defense by not saying I accept diversity, because like there's some Quakers, for example, are very easy people to get along with.
Okay,
but
yeah, I've heard that before.
Westboro Church members, I'm not quite sure I can accept diversity in that particular context. The fact that, you know, same-sex marriage has been opposed by a lot of the standard religion. I'm not sure, as an atheist, I can accept that level of diversity because it's based on religion. If they were basing it on other things, that would be a different conversation.
Yeah.
But if they're basing it on their theistic beliefs and my atheist beliefs go against that, this why can't we all be friends attitude strikes me as having some rough edges.
I don't think it's possible for everyone to be friends. The personalities are so diverse. But it's certainly, I think, a noble goal to work toward, because it's helpful to society.
Well, how much intolerance, though, should we have for the intolerant?
Yeah, this is the problem, the catch-22, I guess. You know, on one hand, we want to have freedom of expression. People want to have the right to have opinions, and you hear people demanding the right to have their opinions respected. The opinions themselves, I think, should be open to ridicule, to skepticism, to inquiry, to to questioning. Mm-hmm. The person's right to hold the opinions is what I think needs to be defended. And I think there's a lot of confusion between the two. There seems to be a blurred line there. And that's where some clarity between those two points might help.
Okay. We're going to come back to the next question. I'm going to go for another break. And when we come back, I'm going to rat out our own atheists about their intellectual dishonesty after this.
Uh-oh.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Empowers you.
And we're back. So, again, I'm going to go back with the whole idea that I'm the, you know, evangelical fundamentalist, atheist guy. And one of the things that we've done on the show quite a number of times is to sort of call out what I would consider to be bad or dishonest atheists or skeptics. The charge is that, you know, if you have not become an atheist for the right reason, you are, well, at best, a weak atheist. That if your disbelief has no foundation, then your belief mainly is equally unfounded. That without the intellectual honesty, non-skeptical atheists are just, well, again, it's a fashion choice and somehow strikes me as dishonest somehow.
I'm not convinced that atheism needs a foundation or any justification at all. The expectation of being an atheist for the right reasons is, to me, entirely optional. Although I have great respect for people like you for having strong, solid, rational reasons to be atheists, I don't favor making it a requirement because, fundamentally, I don't consider atheism to be a position that needs defending, since it can stand on its own merits, of which the only one I'm aware of is the absence of theism. I refuse to accept any expectation that atheism, which makes no claims, has to carry any burden of proof. To say that it is without intellectual honesty is okay with me, too, because I assume that dishonesty is not intended, since you very clearly didn't call it intellectual dishonesty, except before the commercial break. But
yes.
As for people, as far as non-skeptical atheists are concerned, although I feel it is skepticism is a valuable skill that all people should learn because it is so helpful, so useful to people, I see no reason to bar people from using something akin to a mere fashion choice to justify just atheism. I think people should have the freedom to make this choice and not have to justify choosing a religion or not.
So what about being lumped in? Some skeptics and freethinkers do not like the term, not because they don't believe in the concepts, but because some people have also called themselves skeptics, for example, just to use that particular one. And they're the people who say that 9/11 was an inside job. That, you know, there's a sort of a valid guilt or tarnishment by association with some people using these words. Mm-hmm. That if you use that label, it's not in your own best interest to allow it to be misconstrued or warped by other people. So, again, another one that I often call out is Bill Maher, who is a great atheist, loves to support atheism, makes fun of religion all the time. Great, but he also thinks that Western medicine's out to kill him, and that if the label atheist is applied to him, then somehow that has a reflection upon me. That's why that some ways I like to call people out like him, because I don't want there to be this kind of confusion.
Well, you should call people out like him. I didn't know that about Bill Maher. That's a little disappointing, actually, because I do like him. But there's a lot of seems to be a lot of confusion about what the meaning of atheism is. If you look at the various dictionaries, the definitions vary widely. The Oxford Dictionary has the definition that I like, which is simply the absence of belief in deities and supernatural agents like angels and demons and whatnot. But whereas there's other dictionaries that are also popular that define it as a belief that there is no God. Mm-hmm. And that's what I have trouble with, because that's what the anti-theism term is. And it's the atheism term that is simply the a prefix meaning without or absence of, you know. So there seems to be the guilt by association fallacy comes about here. And when we have so many different definitions of atheism floating around, that's why I go back to the etymology and look at the original meaning from the Greek times and their word meaning without gods.
I guess on that same note, I would be guilty of doing the same thing, because whenever I somehow label myself as a communist, I'd say, no, I don't mean those guys. I mean, yeah. We're going way back to where it originally came out, sort of, you know. I thought it was interesting that, you know, I started off the show, you almost think maybe I planned it this way. We were talking about Syria and gassing and how morally reprehensible that is.
Yeah.
You're an atheist, you have no God, therefore you obviously have no morals. What's the foundation of your beliefs? Do you practice the golden rule or anything such as that?
Well, I think many try to. I think the golden rule is flawed.
Oh.
Yeah, and this I find sometimes surprises people. The rule that I live by is to intend to treat others as they prefer to be treated, which is very different from the golden rule, which emphasizes you treating others as you wish to be treated. And I regard that as flawed, because people have different preferences, which are sometimes so varied that treating others based on our own standards is actually problematic and can be oppressive. For example, if you consider, you were mentioning gay people earlier, the homosexuality. For example, if you consider the sexual preferences, the range of interests is so vast from one person to the next that even sexual orientation can seem like a minor point. And this is where the golden rule doesn't work very well, particularly between a straight couple, since each partner is attracted and satisfied in different ways.
On that note, I'm going to pause just for a second, because it's related to this. And I think
okay. It's
something that you're bringing up here, but I think we can even emphasize it, is that I'd add something like affirmative action or race equality or even economic inequality. Mm-hmm. That, you know, some people say, well, listen, you know, if we just had a flat tax, everyone would be treated the same, mm-hmm. right? As in, you know, I'm treating, but that ignores the fact that we all come from different places, and that,
yeah.
you know, what is right for you or what is just for you may not be just for someone else. Again, for example, affirmative action. Mm-hmm. It is true that on the micro level, as a white male, I am being discriminated against, mm-hmm. because, you know, these rules. But that's balanced out by the fact that society itself is unequal, and it balanced out. So I think that's where this sort of do unto others as they would like to be done to, I think, mm-hmm. that's paraphrasing well, is quite valid.
Okay, yeah, and with society, you have a bit of a trade-off there, because people all working together for a similar goal, to all survive as a group. So you do end up giving some concessions. That's natural. I just think we went a little too far with it.
Yeah.
So I guess, and it comes down to, you know, what I think the golden rule does, it kind of gets us away from human solidarity a little bit, and my alternative kind of brings us back towards that a little bit closer. At least that's what I think. Like to me, the human solidarity is probably the most important thing. And unfortunately, division, discrimination, intolerance, and whatnot that we're just talking about works against it. It seems to me like to be human typically includes the ability to question, to think, and to judge, all of which flies into the face of conformity. And this solidarity also notably includes options to celebrate and otherwise enjoy the benefits of being oneself in any manner as one sees fit. As long as that doesn't include, I think, back to society now, oppressing or harming others against their will, it could be a utopia, as the word you brought up there. I believe that this is where empathy and compassion become major factors, and are also what I'd regard as common traits in human identity, which atheism doesn't clearly try to limit or control, and which also affect morals and are kind of fundamental building blocks for morality. A lot of the morality is based on how you get along with other members of society. So it's the values that I hold dear include definitely not oppressing or exploiting others, mm-hmm. but trying to be helpful when they need help, and the Good Samaritan stuff you asked about earlier, offering friendship when they're alone, and protecting them when they're in need of nurture. These are all traits that I suspect come naturally to many people, which I regard as some of the finest hallmarks of humanity, and which my alternative to the Golden Rule wholeheartedly embraces with its intent to treat others as they prefer to be treated.
Good. So, on a slightly different note.
Okay.
Hypothetically, do you think atheism, or maybe more appropriately, especially with the Martin Luther aspect, mm-hmm. Which won't make sense to anyone, but it makes sense to us.
and Martin Luther.
Yes.
or do you mean Martin Luther King?
No.
Martin Luther. Okay.
the idea that, like, could atheists win one day? Could there be, you know, the elimination of religion throughout the world? And why not? What are your thoughts on the whole idea of atheists win, religion wins?
Wins. Wow. I never think of it as a sports game. I don't think atheism really could be eradicated without ending all life. The reason for this is that alternatives to atheism, the theism and anti-theism in particular, requires effort by their followers, preachers, and other advocates to practice, protect, and promote. Atheism is a natural characteristic of life and consciousness, and since consciousness begins without knowledge, so it is that atheism persists naturally, at least initially, and as a matter of course, regardless of whether it's labeled. One can deviate from it, from this natural state of atheism, by becoming a theist, but it will always be an option that is easy to fall back on at any one time. We can always fall back on atheism. On the other hand, every theism is always at risk of being eradicated, even if only by attrition. I think it was Martin Luther who once said that all belief systems ossify over time. This has happened throughout history, actually, which shows examples of religions that have disappeared for various reasons, including being replaced by other religions. Although I've heard that some are making a comeback, some religions making a comeback recently, such as Hellenic polytheism, which worships Zeus and Apollo and the other Olympian deities, or Asatru, which worships Thor and Odin, and so on. It doesn't appear that these are major trends at this point.
And technically speaking, they're usually referred to as neo-paganism, so it's not the religion coming back. It's okay. A re-envisioned. It's like the whole idea of the Druids. We often talk about Druids as being, you know, the ancient Celtic religion, but they all died thousands of years ago. We have no idea what their real religion was.
Right.
We're making guesses, and informed guesses, but still guesses. Yeah. But anyhow, I digress.
Well, and to get back to the why our current theisms are at risk of being eradicated and atheism isn't, is that any belief in deities requires having knowledge of deities, which must first be learned or invented. It's required by theism, implicitly, and to a degree, anti-theism. Yet atheism is free of these requirements, so each person starts their life as an atheist without even realizing it, and only truly becomes aware of what it means to not be a theist after learning about theism. So the atheism label is mostly only necessary when identifying those who aren't theists, and most likely wouldn't even recognize it if there weren't any theisms in the first place. Would that change the fact that every person starts out as an atheist? Obviously not, but this fact also wouldn't be important, relevant, or significant in the absence of a suitable concept like theism to compare with, and so atheism will always be immune to eradication, I think.
Good, again, because to go on with where you started from, yeah. In a very fundamental way, atheism is not the belief system.
That's right.
You know,
it's lack of it.
You could say maybe skepticism, which I think is a form of a belief system because you believe in a particular
sure.
way of viewing the world.
But atheism is not skepticism.
No, right.
No, it's a byproduct of skepticism.
So then I point to you, how do you explain, quote, natural religion? As much as it's sort of the pebble in the shoe of atheism, it is undeniable that some form of sort of supernaturalism seems to be, and please forgive the pun, natural. I think we agree that children are born as atheists, but it's also true, based on the history of humanity, that we have a predilection for belief in supernatural forces, be it Jesus or simply a thunder god or lightning or the boogeyman who's under my bed, you know?
Well, you know, I can recall a debate wherein Christopher Hitchens pointed out that humans are pattern-seeking mammals, and I think he's right, and that there's a tendency for people to seek explanations and default to assumptions instead of leaving questions unresolved. Perhaps it makes them feel more comfortable. I see this religion is just an example of one such assumption. And I regard it as man-made. The various stories about Jesus Christ or Thor and his glorious hammer are two examples of stories that gained a lot of popularity. It's the desire for a higher power probably helps many people feel less alone in this vast universe we're in. But it's not one that I find necessary in my life.
No, and I think, and again, this is going to sound perhaps morbid or not nice, but I've always found it incredibly... annoying? No, offensive. Offensive is the word. When you have like a plane crash.
Okay.
400 people die. One person, usually a kid, who knows, survives.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, you know, thank God that he saved his life. It's like, so thank God he saved his life, but screw everyone else. It's like, you know, but at the same time, to go with what we're saying, I mean, here's this thing that as far as probabilities go, which is ultimately where it all lies,
sure,
you know, was one in a million shot. And people win lotteries and people will survive plane crashes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we don't do math very well, but we do.
Most of us don't.
Yeah. we do people really well. And when you think of the personal God idea,
sure,
it allows us to set up a framework for understanding how this highly improbable thing happened,
mm-hmm,
in a way that we can relate to. Speaking of dealing with things that, you know, that people like to relate to, children, what the heck are they good for?
I think it's pretty important. I used to be a child.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I've been reported to be one, but I don't.
You're in denial.
For parenting, should parents educate their kids as atheists? Should they ignore it because, as we said, it's not really a thing? Maybe what?
I think atheism can be very good for children. It all depends on how you taught it, how it's taught, of course. If there's much to teach with it, I think this is because it leaves atheism, in particular, it leaves children free to question everything without intellectual limits. It gives them opportunity to learn about the world without any inhibitions, so they can study it very honestly. They can be creative without arbitrary boundaries, and even make cartoons that get published in Dutch newspapers someday, and to enjoy life without irrational fears, and to make friends without irrelevant expectations that are handed down by some ancient tradition based on a superstition or a phobia of something unknown. I'm a parent, and as a parent, I'm convinced that it is my duty to ensure, most importantly, that both my daughters are really good at learning and solving problems. It's my duty to inspire them to explore and discover the world around them, and most importantly, to also understand themselves, although only they can do that honestly. And as a parent, I'm in the ideal position, I think, to encourage them to try and guide them in this direction while also nurturing critical and independent thinking skills, which aid this, I think. Teaching children to respect themselves and develop their own set of expectations instead of living up to a set of values and virtues by an imaginary authority that relies on guilt trips or scare tactics to force its will upon others is how atheism factors into parenting, I think, most importantly. If my children became theists later in life, it wouldn't change the fact that I still love them as my children, and they know this. Our older daughter even asked us about this during dinner one night, and that was our answer. To me, this is also how atheism factors into parenting, not as tolerance, but as care and acceptance and respect for children to think freely for themselves.
Now, some would argue, okay, I would argue.
Okay, go for
that
it.
That it's not atheism that one should teach to the children, but skepticism.
Yes.
That, you know, once you have this sort of rational toolkit, the baloney detector, that atheism will naturally fall out from that. But also they will be better educated to deal with the world where there are a lot of dubious claims and charlatans out there that have nothing to do with religion.
Right, yeah, and that's why skepticism, yeah, you're right. That's why skepticism should be the focus, because atheism alone doesn't inspire skepticism. As I mentioned, atheism is a byproduct of skepticism in many cases. I regard atheism as incidental to skepticism, although, and as I mentioned earlier, what Matt Dillahunty said, skepticism leads to atheism. This is why I think he's right. Being armed with critical thinking skills, in my very strong opinion, is one of the best defenses against the charlatans and quack medical practitioners and so on. But as it is with most things, skepticism is a skill that requires practice. And it's one of the reasons I like shows like Radio Freethinker and think it's so important, this show. Because it provides real-world examples of how to be skeptical, or at least that's the main reason I've become a fan of the show, particularly the episode with the museum piece that turns throughout the day.
Yes.
That was classic. Classic skepticism, I thought.
So, you mentioned children, and you know we should treat them to be skeptical. And I don't really think this is so much in the scope of what normally we think of as atheism, or even what we normally think of as skepticism. But it's often one of the rocks that's thrown at us by religious people, and that's about children, ethics, morals. How can you be good without God? We kind of touched on this earlier,
sure.
But with regards, can you focus more about on teaching that as opposed to living that?
Oh, yeah. So I guess like children without teaching your children without religious guidance. It's hard to say. Earlier when I mentioned about the I'm sorry.
So, I'm going to leap in here and maybe give a bit of a framework. I think what I've done is I've thrown in another ism.
Sure.
Classically, we've said we started on atheism. We said, well, you really can't be a great atheism if you're not a skeptic or skepticism.
Okay.
But a lot of what you've been saying is really sans atheism, sans skepticism, but is what people will label as humanism.
Okay.
That we should care about our fellow man. That the source of ethics is not some invisible person in the sky, but because it's just a decent thing to do.
Yeah, and earlier we did talk on that. I talked about how compassion and whatnot can certainly be helpful in developing the moral guidance. Like, we try to teach our kids the importance of empathy, understanding what other people are feeling. Right, because we think that's a very important way for that. It's when you need to get along with your peers, and you need to get along with other people in society, and so embracing and helping and all this kind of thing. We got into the utopia a bit. So
you've heard of, or maybe you had heard of, because you listened to our show,
yeah,
about the atheist church.
Okay.
Right, which is our humanist church. I mean, the banters have been going around.
Yeah.
Which has been sort of trying to supply a non-theistic community group that serves the social functions of the classic church without having the dogma over top of it. I mean, in odd sorts of ways, this is something that's been pioneered in the Scandinavian countries, which have huge number of people going to church and huge number of people who don't believe in any God. It's just a social function.
Yeah, and there are a lot of social functions that are like that already. This one's particularly focused on an audience that's not theist. I'm not totally comfortable with calling it a church.
Yeah, I had some, but they use a lot of variety of terms, right?
We have freedom of expression. They can call it what they want. Yeah. And if there was one around town, I'd probably go just at least a couple of times to see what it's all about. You might meet some interesting people, and it may actually be quite interesting, I think.
So you have kids.
Yeah.
And you want to teach them to be good without religious guidance. And you have done your best job, I am sure.
Yeah.
Where have you screwed up? If you had some things to do over, some things to approach, are there any things that you might say, well,
When they're adults, I think I'll probably know best.
Yes.
Certainly there's things that, with anything in life, you think back on what you've done and you re-examine, and you think, there's a better way it could have been done or could have been handled. That's normal. That's human. It's even parenting is an experience that helps us grow.
Well, what about the idea of generational backlash? I mean, you see this a lot now, at least it's more noticeable, but you see it before, whereas the parents were Jewish, let's say.
Okay.
Right? The kid rebelling against mom and dad, I'm going to go join the Catholic Church because I hate everything my parents were doing, or I just want to be different than what my parents are doing. So aren't you worried that, as sort of promoting atheism to your kids, that in an odd sort of way, that may actually make them more, not sure what the right word here, not, you're not pushing them into the arms of the church, but again, with this generational, I want to set up my own turf and I'm going to reject what you say, Dad, you don't know me. And you might be throwing them in the yard of the Pentecostals, who are really good at brainwashing kids.
So I've heard. I've heard some horror stories. I think children, particularly the younger ones, they tend to want to please the adults in their lives, so the people who rule their world, so to speak. And so I feel it's very important to teach them how to think for themselves rather than what to think, as dictated by who knows what, old doctrine or other people. Although my wife and I teach them values such as honesty and skepticism, which are complementary, we think, along with many other virtues that we think will be helpful to them in the future. We also teach them the importance of trying to understand what the possible future consequences of their choices may be, and to also try to consider their other options, even when the immediate choices facing them seem correct or reasonable. Easier said than done, but we try. You see, there's often gray areas that are left out when one is presented with a limited set of options. We believe that making sure children are aware of this fact before they reach their teens ultimately helps them to make better and more intelligent decisions when they're older. By thinking about the consequences of one's choices and being aware of what's commonly expected in society, morality comes naturally as a self-determined exercise in free will, influenced by empathy and the desire to get along well with others. Religions, on the other hand, provide rigid, predetermined sets of values and virtues, but I don't think that makes them universally moral. Contrary to the same common claims that morality is a universal teaching that requires religious guidance. I see that morality varies depending on a number of factors, including most notably the expectations of society. And I find that religion is inflexibly out of step with this, primarily because it seems to be based on teachings from a time that posed very different challenges compared to what people face today. A few years ago, I was going to say next, our older daughter's schoolmates talked about their religious beliefs in school, sometimes as part of their school assignments that they present to the class after they do all their work. Since they didn't try to convert anyone, I suspect they probably just talked about their beliefs because religion is emphasized at home, probably fairly heavily for some of them. So, of course, our daughter's curious and asking questions about it, so we Googled the internet for information about the different religions her schoolmates talked about. After learning some of the more general points of Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, Islam and Judaism and whatnot, and Wiccan and a few others, and how they differ. She wondered how many religions there are, and so we found a few websites that listed a lot of them. I also introduced her to Pastafarianism and Good. Flying Spaghetti Monster, with the Invisible Pink Unicorn were instant hits, not only with both our daughters, but also with their friends that they mentioned them to. There's something about a spaghetti and meatballs deity flying around and also invisible pink unicorns that appeals to children, probably because in addition to seeing it as ridiculous, they also see it as something fun, like a playground made of giant spaghetti built for climbing, carnival rides, etc.
I am so glad that you are getting your kids off on the right start. You're not being discriminatory. You're introducing them to other belief systems.
We try.
Right.
We're trying.
Because, again, them knowing about it forewarns them about when they're going to be dealt with it beforehand. So, we are at the end of the show. Let me say thank you, Randolph, for showing up.
Sure, Randolph.
Yep. Randolph, sorry. I'm
thank you for names. Having me. It was. I really think it's wonderful to be on the show.
And check out his website, which is at
atheistfrontier.com.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
The cosmos is full.